City of Sydney sponsors 2SER.
Is it a rescue attempt?
Might be.
Yes.
That's supposed to be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falconstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Yeah.
And freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Yay!
There's the contrasts we look for in Film Fight Club.
Well, yay and yeah. Nay. We are Film Fight Club. We like difference.
And then, yeah, because we've been merging into the same person, Chris.
Over time, yeah.
So I feel like we need to bring back the differences.
You might not realize how much we've been merging into the same person if you didn't hear last week's episode because of the technical shenanigans surrounding it.
Yeah, I'm sitting on the side of the desk and I'm basically watching Persona. But for those who didn't hear it, I guess most people didn't hear it.
That was a highbrow reference. I liked it.
Thanks, man. We didn't quite go live properly last week. The show is on the 2SER site and on iTunes and podcasts everywhere. We just had some technical issues with the new desks, but the new desks we now have figured and they are beautiful and lovely, and it's actually much easier to use and just nicer and great.
And on the plus side, you get to hear like an hour plus, like an extended
2 hours.
Bonus.
2 hours.
Yeah, we used
2 hours.
The,
2 hours 28 seconds.
When we tried to go live, it didn't work. Eventually, we just put on the last episode that was uploaded to the server, which was 2 weeks old, halfway through.
The Falkland Islands have just been invaded.
Yeah. So Film Fight Club takes you sometimes forward in time in our when the technical things go wrong, and sometimes back in time in our retrospective episodes. But yeah, we used that as an excuse to go 2 full hours in an episode where we recounted our personal top tens of the year, as well as creating a joint Film Fight Club top six. So if you're interested in what we thought of, this is a perfect opportunity for us to plug the podcast.
Yes, do subscribe.
You can find it in all the places that you find quality podcasts.
I've been actually, a lot of people have been asking me that it's on Spotify, so it's actually a lot easier to listen
to. It is on Spotify, yes. That's right.
So, you know, apparently people are listening to us on Spotify. So there you go, young people, young kids. Spotify, I like you.
So I was listening to today. I was just walking around. And yeah, it felt good.
No, especially the two-hour episode, because everyone wanted to know our top tens.
Yeah. We had fun with that one. I'm curious as to what will be in our top and bottom tens this year. We're reviewing a film this week, which I think maybe not in those lists, but close to one of those ends.
I don't know what you're talking about, Glenn, because I thought it was pretty good. Anyway, but Chris and I seem to be merging into the same person, so it feels like we don't need to do different
top tens. Number 10
anyway.
And number 9 and number 1 and number 2 on our top 10 lists.
So I guess like we don't need to do different movies. It just feels like we can just see one movie once, and that's okay.
I'm taking odds now on Endgame being in one of those lists for Chris.
I'm going to say the odds are near nil. I thought Avengers Infinity War was pretty good, but it didn't crack my top 20 of the year.
Yeah.
The one film that did, that's a superhero film, was Spider-Man. So Into the Spider-Verse.
Into the Spider-Verse, yeah. The actual animated superhero film, not the live-action superhero films.
The good one.
The good one.
Yeah. That's the good one.
People have been talking about Shazam coming out this week, but I have no interest.
We had the opportunity to review Shazam, and we decided not to. So let's give ourselves a pat on the back.
Yes, we're reviewing Destroyer instead.
But the thing is, like, everyone seems to have seen Shazam internationally, seems to be loving it. So
you mean Captain Marvel?
Yeah, Shazam is the original Captain Marvel.
And because I love Zachary Levi. I used to love Chuck, one of my favorite TV shows. It used to be one of my guilty pleasures, the spy kind of, you know, campy spy show. So he seemed to have brought that kind of, you know, vibe to it.
So maybe we'll be talking about it in a subsequent week. However, this week, we'll, in addition to Destroyer, we'll also be talking about Agnes Varda, who passed away this week.
At the ripe old age of 90.
Yes. Yeah. It just seems like she was just always there, and now I'm just surprised that she is not.
Yeah, very much so. We'll talk a bit more about that later.
But one thing we want to touch on before we get into that is the 2SER survey, which opened today. Basically, 2SER want to know a little bit more about your audience and improve things for the future. So please do go online. It's 2SER.com/survey. And just, it opens today, goes till May 1st. And yeah, we just want to improve everything for the future. So hop on there. And yeah, there's links on our social media on the front page of the 2SER site. But for now, we are talking about Destroyer, the new film from Karen Gusama, the director of The Invitation, which we actually talked about last week too. This is starring Nicole Kidman and Sebastian Stan. It is set contemporaneously. Nicole Kidman is a detective who has clearly not having the greatest week, and in the first case of the day, comes upon a body, and events spiral and escalate from there, bringing into focus events that happened in her, very harrowing events, which are totally teased out throughout the film, which happened in her life 17 years ago. It also stars Toby Cabell in a small role. This, I don't think, will make my bottom 10 of the year. It is certainly one of my least favourite of the year thus far. This is a film that sets itself up as a noir, as a neo-noir, but I don't think I can recall a more inconsistent approach to shooting a noir. Parts of it are incredibly bright and light, parts look like a Nicholas Winding Refn film, and parts that look like it was shot by the, you know, Wachowskis, like they're trying to redo The Matrix or something. It was wholly inconsistent. It was a character-driven film in part, but also a plot-driven film which had very lax in terms of plotting. Usually you're supposed to be able to infer this or discover this, but this film, it was very much leaving breadcrumbs instead of allowing you to piece together pieces of the puzzle. There were a couple of more forgiving scenes that I enjoyed. One I'll get into later with Toby Cabell. But for the most part, I found this quite a cumbersome watch.
Yeah. Let's hear it from Farad, because I think I have nothing to say that would differ too much from what Glenn feels about this. I want to bring the fight back to Film Fight Club.
This looks like an actual... Yes, we're fighting.
Because... I don't know, Glenn. What film did you end up seeing? Because I didn't see that film.
You didn't see Dumbo, did you? Because this would have been very awkward then.
No. I wish, because, you know, I really liked Tim Burton and he seems to have lost the plot. I saw this film less as a noir film and more as a character study, actually. But I can see why, Glenn, you would see this film as more as noir, because it's using a lot of those narrative tropes and a lot of that kind of trickery to convince you it's noir. But I don't think it is. It's mostly a gritty character study grounded in Nicole Kidman's character, and it's really that character's journey and the honesty around and conversation around grief and what character has gone through, rather than a thriller, kind of a noir mystery thriller, which it is using a lot of those tropes, but I don't think it is actually that kind of a film.
All right, I agree with Virat that it's way more of a character study, and it's way more interested in getting into the nitty-gritty of Nicole Kidman's character than it is in, and that the noir stuff is more kind of window dressing. But I don't think it succeeds or is very honest as a portrait of grief. Because Nicole Kidman's character is someone who the film wants you to get excited about watching her wreck stuff. It's in the title of the film, Destroyer, right? But rather than being an honest movie about, you know, a bad person, because she's basically a bad cop, a bad mother. She has
a bad person.
Basically a bad person, but it's okay because she's going after the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
I find it cheap to just pin this on, oh, it's okay because she went through some traumatic grief. Because I don't think I think it's sort of like trying to have its cake and eat it too. Like, enjoy watching Nicole Kidman wrecking stuff, but make her into some kind of Christ figure because she went through some bad stuff. It feels cheap to me. It feels like simple pop psychology we often get, where everything about a person can be attributed to one flashback ready explosive, you know, event in the past, and we withhold it, and, you know, until the right moment in the narrative to release it, to reveal it. And when it comes, because this narrative template is so familiar, and it's such an obvious kind of explanation, I don't think there's any big surprises in this movie. But it, as you say, it withholds things like they're the key to everything.
If we're going to treat this as a character study, let's look at it as a character study. I don't think it's a very good character study for the reason, as alluded to, that the key piece of information that we want to know about a character, the key confirmation of the revelation, happens very late in the piece. We needed to reckon with this much earlier if we were going to empathize with her as a character. But on top of that... it isn't really revelation, because everything we essentially need to know about this is told to us much earlier in the piece. And further, if it is going to be a character-focused drama, we can't just focus on one character. Fairly, we do learn enough about the Culkin character, who I feel is a bit of an anachronism. I referred to earlier how it's a noir film. I think she's a classic noir detective in a very 2019 world. We'll return to this more later. But we needed to know more about other characters too. Sebastian Stan, we know next to nothing about him, the secondary character in the film. The one interesting character who we got to know, I think, in the film's far and above best scene, which involved him egging a character through Russian roulette in the flashback. He's a great character. He's sort of this Bodhi-type figure they want him to be. But we still get very little to know about this fellow.
He seems to be interesting. There's this one scene that reveals him to have this kind of power where he's like a Charles Manson-type figure in that scene, basically. But the rest of the movie, he's just a bank robber.
And a boring one.
He's just a boring bank robber.
He's Bodhi in the remake of Point Break, the self-serious one, which no one liked and no one should see because it's terrible.
Speaking of self-serious, yeah. Oh, God.
But, yes, this film was self-serious. I do agree with that point. But actually, coming back to the other point which is made, I don't think Nicole Kidman's character needed to be empathetic. And I do agree with Glenn that, you know, the film would work without that as well. And I think for the majority of the film, it does work without it. And I actually kind of like that aspect that this film doesn't try to make her empathetic at all. And I'm just like, well, if the male flawed noir heroes can get away with not being empathetic, then why can't the female ones too?
See, I disagree on that. I think we get to enjoy watching her be a bad person to an extent, but I think towards the end, and the movie starts saying, oh, it's just because of this, and really she loves her daughter, and really, you know, she's just a damaged person, and it starts treating her like she's actually a magical person who's just been fallen upon, you know, bad fate has fallen upon her, and that's not particularly interesting. On top of that, she seemed to be a pretty bad person already in the flashbacks. What's wrong with just making a character study of a bad person? That's worked on film before, and I don't think this movie... Yeah, this film, I don't think, had the guts to go there.
I think this is why we disagree. I think this film, but the majority of the film, is doing that. It's just doing that. It's only in the last act where it kind of falters and tries to justify or provide some morality, where the most part, it is quite an amoral film. It's not making any judgments as to what these characters are. It's just saying these characters are all kind of
going
bad
back
people.
To what I'm saying earlier, though, it's like the joy of, like, you get to watch someone be bad to bad people, and it's okay because they're bad people, because they're worse. And
it worked in the quite confronting scene where she meets up with the person at the very beginning of the film who was recently released from prison. But on the matter of noir, and particularly men in noir, let's go to the classic example, The Maltese Falcon. That film is a classic because of the ending where you can enormously empathize with Sam Spade. Chinatown, certainly. It's memorable for one of the reasons, that the look in Jake Giddy's eyes at a key crux near towards the end of the film. I feel these characters are good because we can empathize with them. I think they do cause us to empathize with her throughout, but then I think a key revelation towards the end, I think, does undermine that. I'm okay with if it being a character study about someone we can empathize with, or just being a film about bad people doing bad things. This film tried to have it both ways, and I don't think it did it well.
I'll go back to the point that you're making about how it's shot and actually why it's doing totally different things. Sometimes trying to be a Nicholas Winding Refn film, which is a very interesting comparison. I was thinking of Neon Demon while I was watching it as well.
A few shots.
And other things.
I think they just didn't have the budget to make a really interesting look.
Yeah, but actually I did appreciate the fact that they were going for a different kind of look in a generic template as well. So I think I do give it props for this being a more ambitious film, even though it execution-wise it doesn't really execute those things. But still, I really like the ambition in it. It's not just going for a simple, generic noir film.
The thing... The way that they try not to be just a simple generic plot, though, like I think they realize that what they had is really thin. Like this is an incredibly
cliché. It's breadcrumbs. There's no actual let's infer this. It's all let's meet this character and talk to this character. It's an episode of Cold Case, really terrible show.
I think the breadcrumb way that it's constructed, I think, is a realizing that this isn't that interesting a story. It doesn't generally have that much dramatic tension. So an attempt to artificially create that through stringing things along in the plot. And I think
I'm all for that. I mean, movies are not about plot anyway. Plot is the most boring thing about movies.
But this film reneged on plot. A character without spoiling anything, literally brings the evidence of one robbery to another robbery.
Yeah, the plot was stupid.
There are huge... We aren't really going to have spoilers, but there are massive, massive contrivances.
I agree that plot is not necessarily the most interesting thing about... Especially this kind of film. Like, I think the Michael Mann comparison comes up because there's a shootout in this clearly modeled after the big one in Heat. And it's actually quite well executed. One of the better scenes in the film, I would say. But it's the way that this movie tries to get around its uninteresting plot that I found to be even more insulting than the plot. Like, partly it's the breadcrumbs approach, but also the structure and the way that flashbacks are written into the film. And there's
very
a little bit
of... randomly and haphazardly.
Yes, very haphazardly and randomly. Like, there's a moment near the end, to a big confrontation towards the end, where there's a split-second flash to an earlier confrontation involving Nicole Kidman's character and someone else. And these two moments actually don't have anything in common with each other, apart from its moments where she's about to confront someone. And stitching them together like it's making some statement about the character is kind of strange, especially as it comes right at a really climactic moment of the movie. So when it was over, both me and Glenn both said, what was that about? There's also some kind of non-linear timeline play with this movie that...
It's cheap,
exactly.
It doesn't teach us anything.
Yeah, that exactly, because if... it's only there to say, ha ha, fooled you on the part of the writers and, you know, make the people who... okay, I don't want to criticize people who enjoy this movie.
You're making this movie sound more smug than it is.
It's not so much that it's smug, it's that it's stupid. Like, you know, if you're going to do some kind of elaborate timeline trickery, like Memento or whatever, this movie isn't quite on that level, but it tries to pull something on the audience, then... I think that needs to be for a reason, either as, you know, aesthetically or in terms of what it says about the character. It doesn't say anything particularly deep about the character that they do this for, other than this is just how she seems every day, right? You know, which is not exactly a very dramatic thing to drop in, you know, at an extremely crucial point of the film.
The crucial point of the film.
This movie, as it goes on, collapses into cliches that betray the supposedly gritty toughness that it's going for and reveals it to be quite sentimental and quite cheap.
There's one particular cliche. We've seen it as a story beat everywhere involving a revelation about a member of her family. And it's a rather obvious one. They could have let just reveal itself, but they tell us and then lose a actual not... bad reveal that could have happened and clearly was written into the script and one border could have survived on its own.
Yeah.
It's very lazy storytelling. I'd like to touch more on what we were talking about in terms of the style of the film and how it was shot. I don't think it's a matter of low budget. You look at the way what makes noir great is that regardless of the time of day, there is a clear palette. You have a sense of being in one environment. Chinatown did this perfectly. I've read The Maltese Falcon earlier. Neon Demon, a film which is very underrated, did this well. There is a few shots, including one of the diner, which is straight out of Neon Demon. There's moments under a bridge, which are straight out of every dark noir film. There are moments of literal blinding light, as intended, which
it's
are from something else entirely.
It's just not that well-directed.
It's several types of noir. You have to have a consistent storytelling approach, a consistent visual approach. There is no consistent visual approach here. They throw everything at it and hope it sticks.
And
I'm just surprised at you guys, because you guys would be, you know, going all gaga about Mother or Glass.
Mother had a consistent
specifically,
look to it.
I'll give that.
Not just that. I mean, just saying. I think this film is actually ambitious. It doesn't really land in execution, but I think we've been getting behind ambitious films but not landing
but
in execution.
Is this movie actually ambitious?
I think so.
I think this really is a movie that wants you to believe it's ambitious by pulling a load of cheap tricks over very thin material. What this film really is, and what I think it would work much better as if it were to just embrace, is a cheap pulp movie. But it's directed.
You want this to be Mandy?
It would be better, right? Because this film feels it's like it's trying to turn a bunch of cliches into, you know, like this is a deep excavation, you know, of grief and of but really it's just actressing melodrama.
There's so many Oscar shots of Nicole Kidman, whose makeup is awful, by the way. I love Nicole Kidman. She is not good in this film.
I don't think she needed the makeup for it.
But no, she didn't.
Nicole Kidman is best at actressing melodrama. That's what she does. And, you know, when I go into watch a Nicole Kidman movie, that's what I expect from her. I don't expect... When I went to watch Lion, which I hated, I still expected that from her, and she delivered. Actressing melodrama is her forte.
All right, let's look at Lion. Let's look at the others. Let's look at Strangerland. All these films where she is playing dramatic roles, but she is surrounded by dramatic people who are matching her. Not talking about in terms of talent, but in terms of the style. She is straight out of a 60s, 70s noir, rounding around town, a law unto herself. She is a character... This is 2019. She's a character wholly distinct from everyone else in the film. There's a scene where she goes into a club and berates her daughter and her terrible boyfriend. And this...
Well, he was terrible.
And that's... I'm not getting into that. My point is that they all looked at her, whether it was the bouncer or the people in the club, just completely nonplussed, as the audience would. She didn't belong in, not just in terms of, like, what are you doing here, but her character doesn't belong in the setting.
She's from a different film.
She's from a different film. She has, like, this could have been better if they'd lead into the pulpy aesthetic, if it would lead into the comedy, but you couldn't do because it was so dour in so many parts.
Like Marvin Sin City, was that his name? The guy with the massive jaw? Just, like, embrace that there's this weird character going...
Or the
Nicolas Cage Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse.
I would call him a low-budget Thanos with the jaw. But actually, look, I'm really surprised that you guys are just in the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm really feeling lonely out here because I really think this film is not as dishonest as you guys think it is. So, yeah.
I think it's lazy. I think it's lazy. I think it's inconsistent. And I think there is no sense of a finite creative direction which went into it. I think
it says nothing and it does nothing new while acting as though it deserves praise for that. Like
I don't think the score
is awful, by the way. The way that it's constantly...
It's recurring.
Yeah, it's recurring. It's really shrill, and it's constantly, again, trying to create the sense of, like, this is really foreboding, this is really important, when it's always a pitch higher than the film is actually landing.
You want a sense of a score that does this well? Look at Star Trek Into Darkness or Childhood of Alita. Similar scores that actually work well and apply well to the setting.
Speaking of Childhood of Alita, R.I.P. Scott Walker, who composed the score. He died very recently. He also composed a very good score for Vox Lux. He's a legendary musician apart from his recent score work, but that's his direct relevance to the show. And
Thanks.
Incredible music in both of those films.
Yes. One other thing to touch with on this film is we've talked about the dissonant styles, but the very end, the last few minutes, which goes into full, dry, Nicholas Winding Refn cerebral territory, symbolic territory, which actually lacks symbolic territory, which wasn't present anywhere else throughout the film. I'm not sure if this was something they decided to do on the day.
Karen Kusama could not pull that off in this film.
This film is not symbolic of anything.
I agree with that. But at the end, it suddenly goes for that. And it's, again, when we're talking about this lack of cohesive direction, a break from the style of everything that's come before that, you know, lands with a thud because nothing is there to prepare you for that.
It's interesting how that and The Invitation to completely different films. We talked last week in the context of Us, how The Invitation takes a huge leap, like Us does, in its later stages. And it's curious that we see something not dissimilar in this film. This film, aside from the Toby Cabell scene I referred to earlier and the Nicole Kidman and Sebastian Stan's performances, I wish we'd had more Sebastian Stan at this. I'm growing to really like him. Really had no redeeming features for me.
Wow. I would still say to our listeners, give this film a shot. It's still going for other things that most noir films do not even try for. It's going for things. It doesn't land them precisely. There are a lot of plot issues. I do agree with that. But still, I think it's more interesting in what it's trying to do. And I think I've always been a big fan of promoting films which try to do something rather than which just try to be, you know, rehashing templates.
I think that's exactly what this is doing, but I guess you guys can be the judge.
Exactly.
So that is
our first fight in ages, actually. I didn't feel so bad being lonely, but yeah, it's congratulations, guys. We are officially Film Fight Club again.
Officially Film Fight Club. And that was Destroyer. It is in cinemas now. So if you do like films that are noir with Nicole Kidman, recommend Strangerland. It came out a few years ago at the Sydney Film Festival. Really underrated, really underseen. The next thing we are talking about is Agnes Varda, who, as we discussed earlier in this program, after a, I think phenomenal is an understatement, a phenomenal film career. Beyond that, passed away earlier this week.
What's surprising about Agnes Varda's death, which actually hit me pretty hard, even though she was 90 years old, so it shouldn't have come as so much of a surprise, but it did, is because she is, I think at the point she died, she was at a high point of fame and recognition. She just premiered a new retrospective work, a documentary on her creative process and the films she's made and her sources of inspiration that premiered at the Berlin Film Festival last month. She'd been touring the world and giving masterclass lectures. She was seen at the Oscars, getting recognition that, of course, came after none of her actual films were recognized, with the Lifetime Achievement Award in 2017. She also premiered that year Faces Places, which was a beautiful documentary that landed her a lot of respect once again. So she was suddenly very visible and prominent again and did not seem 90 years old. She was so full of life and so full of energy. So it came as a huge surprise for her to be gone. And really, I think this leaves us with only Jean-Luc Godard of the French New Wave filmmakers. So it feels like that era of filmmaking is slipping away.
Yeah, my first introduction to Varda was through Faces Places, which I saw at the Sydney Film Festival when it premiered. Melbourne, actually, I think, one of the ones with Louise we saw, I think.
Yeah, that was the year before last.
Yeah, and I was just so in love with her being in love with films. I think that is something that you got across from a personality, that she just loved filmmaking. She loved the camera work. She loved being in front of films. And I think it's just fascinating to see. And there was a scene in that film where she wants to go and see Godard, and Godard has just been, you know, just a horrible person. Which kind of introduced me to how Godard would be in real life as well, and the image book. So I think it's almost a throwback to what kind of the French New Wave, which people don't realize what it did and what it meant.
What Varda did is was revolutionary at the time. She essentially was a true independent. She entered the scene with almost no exposure to cinema. She'd barely seen any films in her life. Apparently, when she made her first film, she'd seen about 30 films. She came from the world of photography, but she had an intrinsic sense of how to construct a film narrative and how to use the camera. She sought inspiration from outside of cinema. She later went on to become, of course, a huge cinephile, but she carried forth, I think, the spirit, which is trying to make films in different ways. She went on to make one of my absolute favorite films. Whenever I'm asked to make a top 10 list, the films fluctuate, but one film that always makes it in is her film from 1962, Cleo from 5 to 7, which is my favorite French New Wave film.
Wow.
It's a completely, I don't know where to start with Cleo from 5 to 7, but it reveals something that runs through all of Agnes Varda's films, from her first one, Le Point Court, right through to the final film, Faces Places, not counting this new documentary on herself and her work, which is, it's a bit of a cliche to say this about artists when they die, but that she was very, very interested in people, but in a way unlike other, because she always tried to incorporate the world outside of her mind in her work. The first film, Le Point Court, she credited to the people of that town and did a lot of improvisation and development of the story with the residents. Faces Places is about the people, you know, of the towns that she passes through and tries again to incorporate them into her process. And we see that again in Cleo from 5 to 7. It's a movie about exploring a character's mind, but also exploring the world outside a character's mind. The use of the camera to suggest this is absolutely mind-blowing. I think she had an incredible grasp of cinema, but she was using it not just for self-indulgence, but to bring the image to people who are underrepresented in cinema, people at the margins of society, or even people that we might take their interior life for granted. She was a person of extraordinary empathy, and I think that came through in her public appearances as well, that she was such a warm presence and that she had time for everyone.
I wish more people would discover her work, and I think she has a lot to give, and her cinema has a lot to give, so I wish more people can discover her work if they haven't already.
Please do Please do. I know one screening that is happening on, I think it's next Sunday at the Golden Age, is Faces Places. Mm. So I'm going to be popping along to that because I myself haven't seen it.
It's a really, really warm film. All of her documentaries are worth checking out. The Gleaners and I is, another film that's about other people and brings herself into it in a way that isn't indulgent. She really had a way of merging life and art, as Martin Scorsese said, unlike anyone else.
So please do check out the filmography of Agnes Varda, Destroyers in Cinemas Now. We will be back next week with one of our retrospective episodes going back 20 years to review newly released films The Matrix, 10 Things I Hate About You, and Cruel Intentions, which are
in cinemas now. Go check them out.
This has been Chris Evans, Glenn Falcons, and I've Verrett Nehru. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Good night.